Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Miranda July is a filmmaker, artist, and writer. Her collection of stories, No One Belongs Here More Than You, won the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award. She wrote, directed, and starred in The Future and Me and You and Everyone We Know. Her new novel is The First Bad Man, a novel by Miranda July. It is published by Scribner, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Miranda July to the Roundtable. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Did you assume that eventually you would write a novel? Did you always know that?
Kind of. I mean, I think if you dream of being a writer, and I did because both my parents were writers and they ran a publishing company, so I really kind of grew up with that idea of adulthood. A novel is like the great challenge.
So talk about the challenges in pulling it off, in writing it and having it be what you wanted it to be.
It's funny, it wasn't as crazily hard as I thought, and I think that is only because I had made two feature films before. And all the people who are, you know, telling you how hard it's going to be, they actually haven't done that thing, which is actually harder. So I think the challenges of it were, it's a different process than short story writing. I had written my short story collection pretty quickly. Like, each one was sort of an act of passion. I didn't do a ton of revisions. And writing a novel, you just sit in that chair day after day, year after year, and it's not good writing, most of it. You know, it's not that kind of unsustainable but sort of genius moment, you know, when you're filled with feeling. And that's actually what's most interesting about it, is that you're going through all different chapters in your own life as you're writing it. And I started this when I was pregnant and finished it when my son was two. So it was an intense time in my own life, for sure.
Do you think that so many reviewers would say this, and maybe I'm only bringing it up because I read it in a review, but do you think it would be said that this work is cinematic if you didn't have the background of film?
Well, it's funny because I always feel like such an un-cinematic filmmaker. I always feel like a very literary filmmaker.
Right.
So I'm kind of pleased that I'm now being cinematic, although maybe in the wrong medium. And there were some moments where readers of early drafts pointed out that I was doing some kind of filmy things, like cutting between scenes in a way you would do with film, but is really too confusing in a novel. They'd be like, whoa, 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 where are we? And, you know, I thought it was like a genius cut. And you really don't cut in novels that way that often without sort of drawing attention to yourself. So I guess there were a few things that I had to get out of my system.
The First Bad Man is the story of Cheryl. So tell us a little bit about Cheryl. And what I'm fascinated by is the choice of, is obviously telling the story in the first person, which allows you to be so psychological about this character.
Right. It's so intimate. And her inner world is kind of an unreliable, kind of nutty world. And a lot of the book actually hinges on mistakes she makes, you know, things that she misses that no one else would. It's so enjoyable to have a character who's not worldly or even that daring, doing really pretty radical, daring things. I mean, in the realm of like sex and violence, because we're so used to the people who are sexual and violent are also kind of like beautiful and daring. And she's like the opposite of all those things. She's very uptight. She lives alone. She's pear-shaped. She's in her mid-40s. And in a way, it's her blindness and naivete that kind of allows her to move into some wild situations without really seeing them that way.
And it is a novel that addresses motherhood. And as you said, you were pregnant when you started writing the novel. So that obviously has some impact on its creation.
Yeah. I will say I came up with the whole idea for the book well before I got pregnant. And I had that baby character in there. And I think I just figured, well, I'm 37. I think I was 37 at the time. And I know it takes a few years to write a book, so I imagine I'll, if things go the way I want them to, I imagine I'll have something in my head about babies during these years that I'm writing this. And but I didn't exactly know what that was. And in fact, when I handed in my first draft, when I was like 8 months pregnant, I put a little note to my editor that said, I'm not even going to bother fleshing out this baby stuff when in a mere matter of weeks I'll know what the hell I'm talking about, you know, like why fake it? So yeah, I wouldn't say the story wasn't really changed by my real experience, but certainly there's a beating heart there that wouldn't have been there if I'd been making it all up.
You know, I read this novel a few weeks ago, and I loved it. And I love your stories, and I love your work, and it was so much fun to read. Meanwhile, I go to my independent bookstore, and I'm looking, and I see your book there, and it has one of those shelf talkers from the staff, and they're writing about it. And it's from a female staff member who's writing about what a wonderful novel it is. And at the very end, it says, "No man will ever understand or enjoy this book as much as I did."
She's so wrong, right?
I felt that way, and I was going to ask you this question. So immediately, I took out my pad and my phone, and I wrote down the question that I was going to ask you, which is, I mean, do you feel that men can fully understand your work?
I definitely write it for everyone. Like if I thought that, I mean, in a kind of ridiculous way. I mean, clearly there's some people are not only not going to read it, but if they did, they would hate it. But I have a very sort of empathic, like I'm being comforted by the idea of this diverse future audience that includes men, that includes people of all ages, and I do keep that in mind. In fact, when I first shared the novel with readers, I purposely went to strangers, friends of friends that my friends helped me find, and I had kind of a laundry list of people, including like someone who's not my fan, who's kind of skeptical. I want a stranger like that. I want a man. A man was on that list, and I think I was trying to make sure that there was nothing in there that was doing something alienating that I didn't intend, because you can't always see what you're doing. You know, it all feels right to me. And I know it's you know, it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but I just wanted to make sure everything was intentional that might be uncomfortable. And that was hugely useful at that stage.
One of the things that I loved in the book, in the novel, is this sort of cadre of misfits. These wonderful characters who come together, and I believe even in one of the reviews that I read, it likened them to a cast in a Vonnegut novel, and I thought that was very fitting, because there are these wonderful characters that come out, and so that yes, we are seeing this story through Cheryl's eyes, but there are these wonderful characters around her. And I'm curious as to, in your creation of that supporting cast, of what you wanted that to be, so that it would not in any way dilute Cheryl's story.
Right. Well, you know, the story I set out to tell really was just Cheryl and Clee. So all those other characters kind of came of their own accord almost. I remember having a moment, you know, I had this therapist character, and she's just a therapist. I don't know. I was trying it out. It seemed useful to have Cheryl talk to a therapist. And I remember coming out of my writing room and saying to my husband, "You'll never guess what just happened." And I was just like shocked that the therapist had just kind of revealed her own bizarre and submissive relationship with another doctor. And I mean, I was just like laughing with shock as I was writing that. I was like, this can't be. Like, and in truth, just as you said, I thought, yes, maybe it can't be. Maybe that is too much. And so it had to kind of, you know, it took years for that to gather enough weight that it actually became supportive to Cheryl's story and not a distraction.
Was there ever a concern that by doing something or by telling an aspect of Cheryl's thought process that you would make her less sympathetic?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of fine-tuning of her character. And, yeah, I mean, there were things down to the final drafts of that I was adjusting. And it's I think in the end it becomes a matter of degrees, like, you know, like a degree less here, you know, a degree more sympathetic here. And those things really make a difference. So it's not about, like, changing who she is. It's just like the wording. I remember this is hopefully won't turn anyone off because that's not the point of this interview, but there's a point where she imagines, this only happens in her head, someone reaching into a toilet and grabbing a bowel movement.
Right.
And I changed that to that she imagines that they reach in with a slotted spoon.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of change I'm talking about. Like, it's just like one step less repulsive, even though no one ever does that. It's just a thought she'd have. But to even, like, sanitize her thoughts a little bit, you know?
It would seem to me that they would almost become a mantra of something that you would put on a post-it note over your computer that would say one step less repulsive.
Yeah. It was that. And often it was not so much less repulsive as just one step more pride, you know,
yeah.
Like give her something to be good at and you can get away with a lot of weirdness.
Because you ultimately want us, as I think we do, as I did, you want us to like her. You want us to
right.
at least empathize and enjoy the company of this woman.
Right. Yeah. And to care at the end that she has transformed in her way. Yeah.
So this is at the point where I have to ask the obligatory question of when it comes to what is next, and because we were talking about the cinematic nature of this novel, do you return to cinema? Do you want to do that? Do you want this always to be a part of the arsenal?
Yeah, it is pretty much just like that. Like I don't want to lose it, you know? And if it takes so long to do and it's already been, you know, a handful of years since my last movie. And so there's part of me that's thinking like, okay, got to get started. Because in movie, if you just think of me as a filmmaker, like I'm really not prolific at all, you know? And it's kind of a low level pressure, but honestly, whatever sort of pushes you forward. I tend to just rotate. So I don't have the slightest idea what my next novel will be, and thank God I don't really need to think about that until this movie is well underway.
Would you ever make a film of the book?
Yeah. I mean, I thought about it so much when I was writing it. It just seemed like the best movie to me. I was like, God, I wish I needed to write a movie right now. Because it's just, you know, it has suspense and great characters to cast, great women characters. And now that I'm done, it seems like, well, I'm definitely not going to direct it. And I kind of doubt that the like one person that I would love to have direct it would. So, no.
Well, the novel is The First Bad Man. It is by Miranda July, and it's published by Scribner. Miranda July, what a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
A delight. Thank you. The name again of the book is The First Bad Man, a novel by Miranda July. It is published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.